Welcome to This Is Money. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside editor Simon Lambert and me today is reporter Grace Gorsden. And coming up, if you can keep your head while other home buyers lose theirs, you could bag yourself a better deal at this time. Also today, we're busting some energy-saving myths. We look at whether carbon credit offsetting is just a big old waste of money or a good way to save the planet. Also, tis the season to book your festive break. We reveal the top 10 best value destinations for your Christmas holiday. And don't forget, you stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, if you are looking for a new home and you can keep your nerve while others hesitate, now could be a very good time to bag yourself a better deal. Autumn, traditionally, marks a bit of a bounce in the housing market activity, but Rightmove say they've actually seen the opposite. They've seen a 0.2% drop in the average newly listed property asking price, and that's a first-time fall since 2010. And they reckon this gives buyers a rather good opportunity, with expectations amongst sellers just that little bit lower. So welcome both. Simon, why are we seeing this drop? Is it all Brexit?
No, it's not all Brexit.
Okay.
I think it's a bit of that. We certainly appear to have reached the point of peak uncertainty. And I think it's also worth noting that this heavily depends on where in the country you are.
Yeah.
So if you're in London and the commuter belt and the South East, then the property market there has been suffering for some time, particularly in London. And a large part of that is due to the fact that about 4 years ago, the London property market saw something of a mini boom. We had people queuing round the corner to view properties at open houses. Every time a property came to the market, it would come on for £25,000 more than the last one that came onto the market, and so on and so on. There was definitely a bit of the mania going on.
Remember it well?
And that all of a sudden ground to a halt. It coincided pretty well with the Brexit vote, but I don't think that you can say that is entirely responsible for it. What that has done is added an extra level of uncertainty into it. We probably reached the point where people had reached the limit of what they could afford. And also, I think we were running out of a growing band of members of the Bank of Mum and Dad who were able to give their children money to buy a home. And we're talking about them not needing a couple of tens of thousands of pounds leg up, but often £100,000 or £200,000 leg up for some first time buyers in London. So, and then also you have this element where it's drawn out a lot of the European buyers. So if you look back to what happened after the financial crisis, there was a lot of European buyers who were looking at the fact that because the pound had fallen so substantially, London property was at a discount. Also, house prices had fallen, so it was at an even greater discount. You also then had the phenomenon where you had a lot of Europeans coming over to London to work because London bounced back that much bit quicker than most of the other major rival European cities. And certainly Brexit has drawn the heat out of that element. So it's been a bit of a perfect storm. But there's lots of people still sitting there thinking, well, this is the moment of peak uncertainty. I'm going to wait because I think properties are going to become cheaper. What these figures are showing is that although it's only a very small dip nationally, and actually if you look at the figures for London and the South East, it's a bigger dip on asking prices, properties are already cheaper. They have already come down in price. And not only have they come down in price, but sellers have readjusted their expectations. So whereas it was, I'll stick my property on for £25,000 more than the last one that came on, it's I'll stick my property on and hope that I get what the last one came on for. I'll stick it on for cheaper than the last one. And agents who are encouraging people to sell are saying to them, you have to price realistically if you want to get your property sold. And so the best time to buy anything is probably when other people aren't so interested. It's not when there's people queuing around the block to view it and putting in offers above the asking price. And that's what lies behind the suggestion that if you can hold your nerve, then it might be a good time to buy. And actually, this effect has filtered out a little bit. And now you're seeing this uncertainty in areas around the country which had previously been going great guns.
Obviously, we're seeing that little dip. And as Simon rightly pointed out, we're talking about regions here and it all varies. But also we're seeing fewer houses being put on the market. So that would mean there's less choice. And therefore, is it really such a good time for buyers at the moment?
I think if you have seen something like a property that you would like, then probably now is a good time. But perhaps if you were browsing the market generally,
right,
or perhaps if you were a landlord looking for another property, maybe now is not the best time. But if you see something particularly that you like and prices are down, then yes, it would be a good time.
Is there more something more fundamental? Simon, you just said that, you know, Brexit was perhaps, dare I say, the straw that broke the camel's back. But, you know, it made a weak situation slightly weaker. But is there something more fundamental up with the housing market? Or are we expecting this to be a, and it is a very small blip, a short-term kind of blip? And I don't want to put too much on Brexit, but I think a lot of people with it, in theory, coming next month, I say in theory loosely, you can understand why they would might be a little bit nervous.
Yes, I suppose you have to look at
everybody, sellers, buyers, everybody.
Well, I suppose you have to look at the scenario whereby if you think that we could potentially get a deal, then there is the suggestion that all of a sudden there'll be this release of pent-up demand and everything will pick up. Now, whether that's actually true or not, I don't know. But you can definitely see an argument for there being some form of relief rally in quite a few things related to the British economy. At which point, people would start going, oh yeah, actually I'm going to get in now, I'm going to buy, because maybe prices are going to go up now. So if you were looking, now would be a good time to find a place that you're interested in and make an offer, because at the moment the market is depressed, and if we do get a deal, the market will have a bit of wind in its sails.
Yeah.
Now, you're not going to be able to, it's highly unlikely you're going to be able to complete on a property before October the 31st anyway. So you would have that sort of insurance policy of, well, actually, if everything does go to hell in a handcart and we don't get a deal and we don't leave on October the 31st, or, you know, everything gets much worse, then you could still, you know, step out of it. There is another element, which is stamp duty. And in the parts of the housing market that have been suffering the most, stamp duty is a major issue. People are looking at tens of thousands of pounds in tax to move home. People in the sort of £1 million property bracket, which it's very difficult to feel sorry for. But then you've got to bear in mind that they're not actually benefiting from the price of that house that they're buying. They're suffering from it. It's very expensive for them. They've got to take on a much bigger mortgage. They've got to find a much bigger deposit to climb up the ladder. And then being hit with a £40,000 tax bill. And what, generally speaking, you talk to people and they say, yeah, I don't plan on paying a £40,000 tax bill to move home more times in my life than I possibly can. Mm-hmm. And so I reckon it's probably, for most people, suck to move out of the market. We've talked about this before. I reckon I would have moved house one more time in my life by now if it wasn't for the cost of stamp duty. So I think that is a problem. And then also I think, actually, the housing market, when it's a soap opera, isn't it? And watching the soap opera is also a great way to learn about the basics of inflation and deflation. And the idea behind inflation is that it can spiral because people are more likely to buy things now because they think the price is going to rise in the future, and that extra demand to buy things means that the people selling them can push up the prices more, and you get this spiral effect. The problem with deflation, and if you can remember back a few years to when we were all worried about deflation, is if you're convinced that something might get cheaper in the future, you don't buy it now. You wait to buy it in the future. And so that's what's happening at the moment in the places where prices are falling, and people are thinking, well, prices are down, but it might get cheaper in the future, so I'll just wait, and so on. And you can see this effect with you can see this effect in the consumer economy as well, the problem that shops have with the fact that stuff seems to permanently be on sale. And instead of having two big sales a year, they now have 10 big sales a year. So nobody buys anything unless it's on sale because they expect it to get cheaper in the future.
Yeah, true. All right, we're going to leave that to one side. We're going to assume that you've got your house, you're in your house. And now one of the big money pits, we're going to talk about that, and that's energy bills. But there are lots of things you can do to cut down on your energy bills, and this is not just another feature about switching. This is not really at all. We're going to discuss some sort of energy myth-busting, I think, some red herrings that you might be told. Can someone just answer the question? My mum always used to say this. Always turn out the lights, and then someone would argue, no, the turning on and off uses more energy, so it's better to leave them on. Does anyone have a definitive answer on that?
No definitive answer, but I think nowadays it would say just to leave them off, to be honest. I think you can have energy-saving light bulbs, which will use less energy, but I actually think overall, just turn them off.
Turn them off. All right. Okay,
yeah, it's not true. Yeah, I don't believe that's true. I also believe that.
To turn them on
yeah,
and off
it's also not true of cars either. The whole idea of turning the car on and off uses up more petrol than just turning the car off and leaving it off.
Yeah.
You'd have to be doing it over very, very short periods of time. Right. And also with modern cars and their stop start technology that they have, that's actually deliberately to save fuel. So in those, it definitely isn't true.
Well, I don't know about the cars, but certainly I've got to applaud my seven-year-old self for, you know, at least trying with that argument. But anyway, so I want to know the ones that you really can save energy. And the first thing that pops up, vampire energy. It sounds like a brand new kind of energy firm, doesn't it? First of all, when I read this, I thought, oh, God, not another one. But no, it's not. What is vampire energy? Grace?
So vampire energy is when you leave an electric appliance plugged in, for example, your phone. Mm. It's not turned on, so it's not technically charging, but it is still using electricity. I mean, you might come back and you'll find your phone is still warm after it's been plugged in, even if it's not actually turned on at the switch. So there is still a supply of energy going through. Obviously, nowhere near as much as if it was turned on, but this is adding onto your energy bills. It may not be huge amounts, but it does add up over time. Right. I mean, I suppose if you have a TV plugged in and it's not on, you still have a light on. So there has to be some energy source coming through it. But it's a fuss to turn every electric appliance off at the switch if you come in and out. You'd be there for ages, especially nowadays with the amount we have. But the point is, this is vampire energy. It is sucking energy. It is adding on to your bills. Mm. Perhaps not noticeable amounts, but over time, the course of the year, it can cost £80, which may not seem like a huge amount, but if you can save £80, you'd want to. Just unplugging your phone before you leave. It's just one of those simple things you can do to save yourself a bit of money.
Not just about saving money, it's good for the environment, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Well, as we know, the less energy you use, the smaller your carbon footprint, which is one of the main problems that we're all facing these days is the environment. So anything you can do to cut down your energy usage to help the environment is a good thing, really.
Yeah. What else is in there?
So when drying clothes in a washer or tumble dryer, yeah, throw in a dry towel. This is a great way to absorb excess damp and means the appliance can be used for half the time.
Well, that is a little tip, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And most modern washer dryers or tumble dryers, instead of going for a set amount of time, can work out whether the clothes are dry or not. So when you put the our washer dryer on, right, it tells us it's going to take 2.5 hours, but sometimes it's done in an hour or an hour and a bit because actually the stuff is dry. So it knows how dry the stuff inside is rather than just running for 2.5 hours. So if you chuck your dry towel in, that will help you out and it'll be on for less time. And that has the added bonus of not having your washer dryer or your tumble dryer going round and round and round making loads of noise, which, if you live in small places, is really annoying. I'd love a utility room.
I know. Well, that's, you've highlighted another energy-saving tip there. Obviously, make the most of the appliances that you have already. But you know, mine is way not that posh, Simon. It's not a smart washing machine.
Ours isn't an expensive washer dryer.
Yes, okay. But still, it's not that posh. But that might be a good tip for me to, you know, invest in the future. Grace, give me another one.
I'm not sure how practical this one would be for everyone. One of the tips that has been suggested is keeping your fridge and freezer full, not to keep your fridge and freezer full, sorry, and fill it with bowls and jugs of water, as the fridge and freezer will then be able to regulate the temperature more easily. And it has advised people to stop purchasing extra goods for the sake of it.
Surely to get bowls in your fridge, and I've got a very diddy fridge, you'd have to have a bigger fridge, which would probably use up more energy. So I'm not convinced by that one.
I mean, my issue is, firstly, there's always loads of stuff in our fridge, and it's normally full, and it needs to clear out periodically. We did do that before we went on holiday in summer, and we came back to this blessedly empty fridge. You opened it. It was like, oh, everything in there looks so lonely. And it was wonderful. It was an absolute pleasure to be using the fridge and able to find things rather than knocking things left, right and centre. Now, having been home for 2 weeks, it's full of stuff again. And I'm like, oh, I miss the old, more empty, clean lines, modernistic fridge that we had. But secondly, a fridge full of bowls of water for me would be a recipe for water all over the fridge and the floor as I knock them flying when I try to reach something out the back.
Yeah, exactly. All right, Simon, final one.
Okay, this is not your house. This is a common question. To keep cool in the car, it's better to wind the windows down if driving at a lower speed, but use the air conditioning if you're going quicker. And it says here 60 miles an hour or more. I reckon it's probably lower than that. I reckon it's probably about 50 miles an hour.
And the reason?
The reason being that driving with the windows down at speed decreases your fuel efficiency substantially, makes the car less aerodynamic. But using the air conditioning at low speed puts more strain on the car, and so you use more fuel. I think that's one that we need to dig into in more detail.
All right, we'll do
I
that.
I think that's got Rob Hull's name written all over it.
Ask him while he's at it. It's not car related, but to do the bowl, the water bowl test, because I'm curious about that one. Any myths as well? I want to ask a little bit later on about energy meters and whether they are actually helping people to save energy. But before we get there, any myths that people really think work and they just don't?
I think an interesting one that actually came out of this was it is actually better to use a dishwasher than it is to clean your bowls and plates by hand. The advice given that was most newer models of dishwashers are actually more efficient. They use less water and obviously they dry the dishes as well. And you will generally be using less water and less energy. You won't need to heat the water as much if you just use a dishwasher, which I would never have thought, but apparently that is the case.
Especially as a lot of people nowadays, myself included, when washing dishes, do it with the tap
running,
on,
without a
running
bowl.
All the time yeah, without a bowl. Because you need the hot water to clean the stuff off the plates properly. And yeah, it's just, you know. I don't need to
and it's a better clean, but either way. Okay, well, I'm going to ask you, I know it's smart meters, because there was a time when we talked about it a heck of a lot, but controversy, you know, are they as good as suggesting that they might be, those who are supportive of them? And then we had the ones that didn't work, and then there was a big delay. Big old mess, isn't it? Is it still a big old mess? Where are we at with that?
I think more people than ever are frustrated with smart meters, I will be honest. I hear from readers all the time, every single day. I'll have a ream of emails from people complaining about their energy company or their smart meter, be it they have one and it's not working, or be it that their provider is forcing them to have one and they don't want one.
They can't force you though, can they?
Well, they cannot. Legally, they cannot, except some suppliers, which I won't name, have been known to send out letters to their customers saying, by law, you have to have a smart meter. So there are some sneaky suppliers who are trying to get around this and trying to hit their targets by duping their customers. But so the second generation smart meter rollout, which should have been completely in place from the 15th of March this year, was set to replace all of the first generation meters, which were the ones that were going dumb, losing all their functionality when customers switched suppliers, rendering them useless and obviously frustrating a lot of people. But there have been numerous problems with this rollout, one being that a lot of people aren't being offered them to start with. Secondly, that people who live in the north of the country or people that live in high-rise flats have been told they won't be able to have them as the technology is not yet in place there. And it seems that unless you live in central London or around the southeast area, you're unlikely to get a second-generation meter and one that's working. Mm. So there's a lot of money that's been spent on this rollout that not a lot of results, I don't think, have been seen for a lot of people, unfortunately.
All right, so it continues. Does it actually save us any energy, though?
It shows how much you're using, and the point is that you can determine from seeing how much you're spending whether you would like to be spending less and on what sort of energy devices could you be spending less. Therefore, do I need to leave the heating off for longer rather than keeping it on all day, that sort of thing. But unless you're using it properly, monitoring how much you're spending, it won't save you money. It's not a money-saving device in itself. It depends on how households use it to their advantage.
Is yours still in your cupboard, Simon?
Well, there's two unplugged parts to a smart meter. There's the bit that tells you how much energy you're using that you can have in your home and look at, and then there's the smart meter that talks to your energy supplier and does your stuff with your energy bills. Now, the bit that tells me how much energy we were using went straight in the cupboard because it was plugged in on the side in the kitchen, and that's where we normally plug in phones and stuff. So I unplugged it and then I put it in the cupboard to move it out of the way, and it's still in the back of the cupboard somewhere. Yeah. The smart meter itself that talks to the energy supplier, I'm a big fan of. I have no problem with these things. Thought it was great in principle because it gives me accurate, up-to-date energy billing. I could check with my supplier what my energy bill was at any given time, and my energy bills would be accurate. And instead of swinging around wildly as they estimated your readings and your direct debit changed all the time, and all of a sudden you'd find yourself, you know, massively in credit, then you were massively in debit, and you could never quite work it out. Mm-hmm. It seemed to be a much better system. Unfortunately, I then moved energy supplier from Ovo to Bulb, and Bulb couldn't support Ovo's smart meter that they'd put in. So the smart meter is now dumb, and I keep getting letters from Bulb asking me to take an energy meter reading. And then when I went to take an energy meter reading, I was met with a blank screen. Yeah, I pressed the button that looked like it might turn it on, and it did something weird and then went off again. So I need to sort that out. So I think that the problem is that smart meters in themselves are a good idea. I think they would benefit lots of people. I can understand why some people are reluctant, but realistically, who wants to take meter readings? I'm sure there's a small selection of people out there who actually enjoy taking regular meter readings and sending them through to their energy supplier, but I reckon they're a small band folk. So I think they're a good idea. I think the rollout has been pretty poor. The energy companies have not exactly covered themselves in glory. But this delay and what's going on now and what Smart Energy GB, the people behind this, are doing is basically really good. It's what we've been saying needed to be done, that this deadline needed to be delayed, what lots of critics have been saying it needs to be delayed. It gives them much more time to sort it out. Apparently they are getting on top of this issue. That means I have a dumb smart meter. And if they can do it all properly from this point on, then I think it will change things substantially.
All right. Well, we shall see. We shall see. We're going to stick with energy saving. You may have heard the idea of buying carbon credits to save the planet. It's all very fashionable now since the Duchess of Sussex apparently bought some to offset her flight across the Atlantic to watch Serena Williams in the US Open tennis earlier this month. But critics say, unless you are careful, you could be just chucking your money away. All right. So, Grace, tell us more.
Carbon credits, also known as carbon offsetting, is when you pay money to a company who promises to offset the damage you've done to the environment already. And what they do is they put the money into green projects, which usually involves things like planting more trees. There is some debate about how good these companies actually are. And there's been talk of quite a few being scam companies, that they're not actually doing what they say they're doing and they're just after your money.
Is it when you go and you buy a flight and at the end they say, would you like to round up to put towards green things?
Is that BA does that, yeah. But it's not quite clear how much of it is going towards that green thing, because they also do a thing for charity as well. Mm. And also it's not, they offer a different amounts that you can round up, but it's not clear, as I said, how much of it is going to that and whether you're actually doing enough to do it. And what's interesting in Toby Warren's story here is, he highlights that you need to look for the gold standard measure of these schemes. Basically, the gold standard is a not-for-profit organisation based in Switzerland that sets international standards for carbon certificates. It ensures that the environmental work is carried out to a high standard before allowing traders to issue their carbon certificates. Separately, the United Nations has a clean development mechanism that checks that money is invested in credible projects. Because that's the thing you'd worry about, is this money actually going into it?
Yeah.
And the four listed here, the cost of it varies wildly. So to offset 1 tonne of carbon dioxide, which is about an economy flight to New York, Atmosphere would be £20.65, World Land Trust would be £15, Climate Care would be £7.50, and Carbon Footprint would be £6. It's because they put it into different types of projects. So carbon footprint projects include reforestation in Africa and drilling boreholes for clean water in Uganda, whereas atmosphere projects include biomass generators in India and wind turbines in Nicaragua. So most people's concern would be, is this actually going into doing something? And what I'd be very interested to know is how many trees do you have to plant, which we don't have in this article. And I think I'm going to try and follow this up and find that out. And if every time you took a flight, you just found somewhere in the UK to actually go and plant a tree yourself, and then you looked after it, would that be enough? Or would you need to plant more trees than that? Would you need to plant a bit of a wood or a bit of a forest? Is it beyond an individual?
Probably. We
I mean, you need the land, obviously, but you can always find a bit of land where you can plant a tree. No one's going to know. You just go back.
But the best thing, as we know, is not to take those flights. And I am not saying anything disrespectful to the Duchess of Sussex. I am just leaving that one. I think she's a marvellous lady.
Who may or may not have done carbon offsetting.
Who may or may not. So
she definitely got the plane. I don't think she gutted it over on a boat.
But I do know that she's doing great work and she's a big fan of all this sort of jazz. But what I do want to ask is the question that naturally comes up with this. Is this just a way for rich people to assuage their guilt?
No, it is not, because actually one of the most important things to combat climate change is the way that we look after the land and the planet. And reforestation, regenerative farming, projects like rewilding projects have the ability to capture huge amounts of carbon. Just changing the way that we farm in this country from intensive farming to more regenerative farming, using much less fertilizer, using cover crops and things like that, would make an absolutely massive difference. So if this stuff is actually being done, then it does make a very big difference. But there is another argument saying that we should be paying more taxes on the flights that we take to discourage us from taking them, and we should stop relentlessly expanding airports.
Which goes back to my point. There's no question, I don't know the science behind it, in terms of whether these projects are actually any good and whether they work. You've persuaded me, Simon. But it does just feel to me that if we do start taxing flights, etc., etc., it's going to hit those people who can't afford to take those flights, so they won't take those flights. And the rich people just go, oh, it's fine, whatever. It's that prevention is better than cure kind of attitude. But actually, you know, if you're a rich person, what does it matter? Just take that flight to New York on a whim, or anywhere else you want to go, and you just give a bit of money to carbon offsetting, and maybe, you know what, I feel better about it.
Yeah, and it is common knowledge, prevention, as you say, rather than cure. So doing things that will stop damaging the environment rather than making up for the damage that you're actually doing. Mm. So rather than continuing to take long flights, I mean, I'm not one to speak, I've just flown back from Bali, but is, nice. You know, to eat less meat, is to use more public transport, buy electric vehicles if you are able to, if you have the money to, cut down on your energy usage where you can, take as many steps as possible as you can within your remit, within your life, to stop damaging the environment. I think it is a good idea, carbon offsetting, because I think it gives people an opportunity to feel like they're at least doing something to help the environment if they're going to take these flights anyway. But I do think that having more taxes on flights, long-haul flights to begin with, is a good idea. But as you say, then that will stop certain people taking them. But I think we all need to realise that the damage that we're doing and continue to do is not going to stop unless action is taken, unfortunately.
I feel really bad now, because the next thing we're going to talk about is how to get a cheap flight. But that is where we're going to go. And I feel doubly bad because it's going to mention the C word. Christmas! But this is about saving money, not spending money. So that's quite rare in the context of Christmas. But we are being advised, if you want to get a better flight or a better deal on accommodation or flight, or both, start thinking about your holiday plans now, because apparently the best time to book four flights for Crimbo is 13 weeks in advance. So do a bit of maths. That works out as the last week of September. So Simon, how much can you save here? Once we've got over the moral guilt, obviously, of taking that flight.
So the travel comparison website that did this research found that Tenerife was the best value destination to visit for some winter sun, with an average price drop of 33% when compared to last year. Closely followed by Palma, which is a price drop of 31%, and Prague, which is a reduction of 23%. And Buenos Aires, the best value long-haul destination. You'll need to plant some trees for that one. Saving travellers 22% year on year. And this is the research that Skyscanner has done for flights between 16th of December and the 31st of December. Mm-hmm. What I found interesting is that it said that Christmas Day is the most expensive day to fly out of the UK, while the cheapest day to travel in the festive period is the 23rd of December. I always thought Christmas Day was a cheap day to fly on.
No idea. I don't know what. I always wonder why anyone would want to fly on Christmas Day.
Because it's cheap, I thought.
Oh, fair enough. Or if you don't celebrate Christmas and you don't really care, that's fair enough. I was going to ask that final question, but I don't want this to be my final question. But are we noticing that people are sort of being slightly put off of travel plans because of Brexit?
I would imagine so. For this Christmas in particular, if Brexit does go ahead as planned, then when people travel this Christmas, we will be out of the EU. And so that will obviously affect a lot of people. It will affect their decision making as to where they're going to travel, whether they travel in the rest of the EU at all. But I think it will remain to be seen actually when, I wanted to say if then, but when Brexit goes ahead, as to what will actually happen to destination prices. I'll be interested to see where is cheaper, where is more expensive, where are people looking to go. So I do think some people will be putting off their travel plans, which is probably why some of these destinations are down by so much. I mean, 33% year on year is a massive reduction for somewhere like Tenerife.
Okay, so that's flying. That's Tenerife. Good for me. I've got family over there. But what if you don't want to fly? What about trains and all that sort of thing, Simon?
Well, if you want to get a train, then you should also be looking at it now. Particularly if you want to get a train overseas. So Eurostar released a load of cheap train tickets last week. Now, I'm guessing that a lot of those £29 train tickets are going to be gone now. And just to say, those £29 train tickets to Paris really did exist, because I looked at going on a Saturday morning early, coming back on a Sunday afternoon for me, my wife and the kids, and we could have all gone for £29 each. That's each way, so it's you know, you've got to pay double
and
that
the
for the return. And the kids, yeah, they really want to go to Paris, and I thought it'd be really cool for them
but
to get the train to Paris.
The kids are the same price as the
parents. The kids are the same price as the parents on the Eurostar, yeah. But if it's only £29, that's not that bad. So those do exist. So if you wanted to get a train somewhere in Europe, then you won't have to plant so many trees to make up for it. Then I'd look at that now as well, because whilst those £29 tickets will have gone, as I said, I reckon there'll still be quite a few of them around fairly cheap, especially if people are thinking, maybe I may or may not travel, kind of thing.
That's not bad, is it? All right, well, that's it for this week. You can stay up to date with all the latest Breaking Money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you would like to make any comment, anything you'd like us to investigate, or any cheap deals you've got on holidays, do let us know.
Yep, email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk, tweet us at thisismoney, or come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast, where you can find all the podcast paths and join in the debate in reader comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.